Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Okay, greetings everyone, and welcome to another episode of Recall This Book. Today I'm delighted to be here again with my friend and co-producer and co-host John Plotz from the English Department of Brandeis. Hi, John.
Hey, Elizabeth.
And especially happy to have Professor Daron Wallace with us. Daron is Associate Professor of Sociology and Education at Brandeis, and he has a PhD from the University of Cambridge, and he is the author of the recently released book, The Culture Trap, Ethnic Expectations and Unequal Schooling for Black Youth, which is out with Oxford University Press and is going to be the topic of our episode today. So hello, Daron, and welcome.
Hello, Elizabeth. Hi, John. So good to be here. And it's, you know, I've been able to have conversations with folks about my work who are sociologists or education scholars or, you know, immigration study scholars, but it's such a delight to have a conversation with scholars from different disciplines, right? Scholar in English and anthropology. But what is more, it feels like a really special honor to do so with colleagues from my own university. Feels really special. So thank you so much for this.
Yeah, well, thank you. And that's really gets at the heart of Recall This Book, too.
Yeah. I feel like if we knew the Waltham City Anthem, we could sing it now. And that
John, in my case, only if it's the Jamaican anthem.
Okay.
There you go, yeah. Okay, so Daron, could we start off by just having you tell us a little bit about the project and the book?
Sure. This project is a cross-national study. The book is a cross-national study of Black Caribbean youth in London and New York City. Since the 1920s, Black Caribbeans have been deemed a high-achieving Black model minority relative to African Americans, whereas in the UK context since the 1960s, they've been deemed the chronically underachieving minority. In both contexts, it is argued that there's something intrinsic to their culture that produces these outcomes, this culture of success in the US and a culture of failure in the UK. Well, this cross-national study calls into question the significance of culture and spotlights the importance of national policy context in shaping the divergent outcome of the same ethnic group. What I'm arguing fundamentally here is that there's so much about the relationship between culture and structure that's being relegated and simplified to purely being a matter of culture. And that is what I argue is the culture trap, right? It sort of splinters Black political power. It limits our capacity to understand the full range of structural and cultural inequalities that exist in schools and in society. It is both an epistemological and an analytical sort of limit that we place both in sort of academic discourse, but also in sort of popular culture, popular understandings of contemporary social affairs that I'm trying to unpick in this work. There's nothing in the tradition of Stuart Hall and Pierre Bourdieu, there's nothing intrinsic to the culture of Black Caribbeans, I argue in this book, or any specific group, frankly, that aids success or failure. It's also about the context of reception. It's also about the class dimensions of migration, right, that shapes who goes where. It's also about the order of Black migration, as I discuss in the book. There are a range of structural, historical, and political factors that shapes the reception of a particular cultural group to a national context. And this is what we often miss in contemporary discussions in education, probably, but also in general discussions about who's successful or who's a failure in society. The impetus for the project, I must add, though, I had no, and I feel so grateful that I can say this now because the book is done, I had no interest in sort of studying Black Caribbeans. I was actually studying economic development, right? So much of my work, I went to graduate school to study economics, the economics of education in particular. And I was working as a community organizer, and I had a chance encounter, which I describe in the opening scenes of the book, with a veteran Black Caribbean teacher who was surprised at the time that I was Black Caribbean and studying at Cambridge. And Her response to me was, when I told her I studied at Cambridge, she said, "And your Caribbean?" And she was very shocked. And I remember thinking to myself, well, in the US, it was a complete opposite, right? That this sort of narrative. And I recall, even from my first year in university, debates between noted legal scholar Lonnie Guinier and Henry Louis Gates Jr. about the sort of which particular cohort of Blacks, or which types of Blacks were we seeing in the Ivy League? And they were describing at sort of a Black alumni conference that Black immigrants were disproportionately represented among Black students in the Ivy League, right? And in particular, this sort of at that time, that Black Caribbeans constituted the largest share of the sort of Black immigrant population among those in the Ivy League, right? So a very, very different sort of policy context and public in the tradition of Stuart Hall, different representation of the same group. But as I, you know, after I had my conversation with her in community organizing, we used to encourage folks to sort of write down notes with leaders, right? So that the next time you meet them, you could remember. I'm only sharing this because community organizing shaped my ethnographic sensibilities, right? So long before became like an onerous task of documenting everything, it actually was part of my everyday practice as an organizer. And I realized quickly, I went back, spoke to my friends, spoke to people in the neighborhood about what was going on. And they said, yeah, this has been going on for decades. How did you not know? And I was like, well, it's the opposite where I'm coming from. I didn't know. I leafed through every sociology book I could find, Black studies, history textbooks, and I could not find a text that could speak to these divergences, you know, in representations across two different national contexts. And so kicking and screaming, I decided I would write this book. Now it's out and I'm elated it is out.
Well, it's kind of ironic because you're, you know, critiquing the notion of culture, and yet you were sort of drawn into, you weren't going to study culture and then you were, right?
Yeah.
And you were drawn into it. So, so in some sense, it trapped you as well, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I would say I wouldn't say it trapped me, I would say it captivated me. Right? It really lured me in and invited me to sort of think through a problem that I was seeing playing out from a deficit standpoint in the UK context, right?
Right.
Even more recent reports, like the Sewell report, which came out just about a year and a half ago. Tony Sewell is a policy advocate, and he was asked to write this report basically on sort of the state of race in Britain. And he made a couple of really strong claims, you know, about Britain, that race was no longer a key issue, that it was far more equal in Britain than across Europe, that the greatest accomplishments can be seen in education. And he goes on to say, you know, the major exception to these are like Black Caribbean people who, he's himself is Black Caribbean. That's the latest iteration of that sort of narrative. But I can think others where this is rehearsed regularly, particularly as exam grades come out and consistently Black Caribbean students fall to the bottom. Right, that this narrative around culture gets sort of reasserted as the rationale for their achievement.
Right.
Are there other international sort of like sort of comparandums? Like, I guess maybe France and America with Vietnamese Americans. I don't know what the other cases would be, but I'd be interested to know how you thought about these other cases where you get divergent, you know, perceived outcomes in different of the same immigrant group.
Yeah, so it nothing conclusive. There's been some anecdotal evidence to suggest that how particular groups fare varies across context. So there have been some reports about particular groups of Asians not faring as well in, say, Australia, right, as the United States, right? But you know, it's part of what I hope to think about later, and it's part of why I theorize the culture trap the way that I do, because while I want to think about the case of Black Caribbeans with specificity and depth, the theoretical argument I'm making far exceeds the case of Black Caribbeans, right?
Yeah.
And there are other groups around the world, which I think is what your question gestures towards, John, also experiencing this as well.
It definitely does. And I like the point that you're making about it being in a variety of contexts. But I was also specifically pulling on something that I think both Elizabeth and I were interested in, which is the notion of like what I think you call direct versus indirect settler colonial context.
So I was primary and secondary, maybe?
Primary and secondary. Thank you. But like, you know, instances where people are coming to what is perceived as like the quote mother country, as you know, our colleague Howie Tam studies Vietnamese Francophone literature and Vietnamese literature in America. And it's like an interesting, the comparison that even, you know, might line up in interesting ways.
Yeah. And that, I mean, to me, that's so, you know, one of the things that I really love about the book is the way that you, you include in the first place, just to say very clearly, like, it's such a striking case where, you know, you have these very divergent situations, but both of them are attributed to culture, mm-hmm. right? In one place they succeed, in one place they fail, relatively speaking. Mm-hmm. And in both cases, it's attributed to culture. So it really, you know, allows you to push on the implications of the culture concept and the ways in which it gets wielded so effectively. The thing about the primary and secondary that I wanted to ask you about, because I think it's so, it really speaks to this, you know, you have sections where you talk, for instance, about, and please correct me if I'm mischaracterizing this, but that in some ways the educational system in the Caribbean, at least in the British Caribbean, mm-hmm. is not only kind of extolling the British system as the best of the best, but also modeled after it and somewhat like it, right? So in some ways there's, but I think it's also, there's this way in which you give the opportunity to talk about colonialism as something that is, you know, very relational, more relational than people sort of think about it sometimes. Like, it really matters that, you know, Caribbeans in New York, for instance, kind of have the position of immigrants who are not part of already a kind of colonial context. Mm-hmm. Whereas in Britain, they're colonial subjects who are kind of out of place. Mm-hmm. Or what do you think about that?
Yeah, that was a, that's one of the chapters I almost threw out of the book.
Well, I'm glad you didn't.
But I'm so glad I didn't, on the advice of sort of, families that were part of the study, my own family and mentors. I wanted to have a clear conversation in that chapter about a really key point that I think challenges traditional immigration studies work. And that is, when we think about cross-national work, we tend to think you can compare those people, often immigrants or the children of immigrants, in the two host societies within which they find themselves.
Yeah.
And the main point I'm trying to make in that chapter is that you cannot possibly understand the experiences of Black Caribbeans in either London or New York City unless you're understanding their perceptions of the whole society from the homeland. It therefore means we no longer have a two-way comparison, we have a three-way comparison.
The larger point,
right, then is you can't understand any immigrant by simply focusing on their experiences in, you know, New York, Miami, Paris, Amsterdam. You also must relationally understand both the circuits of power that shaped their migration to that context, but also their perceptions of that city context, that new whole society from the homeland.
Yeah,
and that's
great.
Brought me to the analysis of sort of colonialism's impact. A lot of what I'm thinking about now is what I regard as the educational legacies of empire, right? The ways in which long after the sort of constitutional collapse sort of dominant post-colonial regimes, we can start to think our colonial regimes, and this sort of march into independence, as it were, we can think about how through the structure of schools, right, what we teach, how the schools are structured, the sort of how teachers extol a particular nation state or its schooling and how it sort of imbibes this sense of belonging and even being, as it were, in a former colonial power, but still sustaining at an effective level that colonial relation, right?
I want
to pick that in my work and hadn't seen much of that to date. You're absolutely right, Elizabeth. In the work, I pay attention to the fact that Black Caribbeans who went to the United Kingdom were primary subjects of British colonialism, right? Even before they went to the United Kingdom as immigrants, right? Whereas Black Caribbeans who came to the United States were secondary subjects of U.S. settler colonialism, right?
Right.
Both the differences in the types of sort of the different structures of these colonial relations and the order in which they fall matters tremendously for the status and their representation in the nation state. What I'm trying to get is, again, something that you think you can simply dismiss as a matter of culture is profoundly historical, deeply structural. And you know, I also want to make the claim, because sociologists went through this in the late 60s, 70s, this rejection of culture that you sort of gestured towards as well, Elizabeth, following the Moynihan Report and a host of other reports that really were, you know, advancing rather pathological views on Black families in particular. And so the critical scholars were distancing themselves from that narrative. What I'm trying to do in this moment is I want to take culture so seriously as to understand it so deeply that I must engage with its relationship to structure.
Exactly.
It's not dismiss culture. It's actually to take it so seriously as to understand how, not just the meaning making around it, but how it is framed and understood and structured in a particular context, right?
Yeah.
So that's my mode of engagement in relation to culture. And I hope that engages.
And that's where you, I mean, what it seems to me is that's where your legacy, or the legacy of Stuart Hall and Pierre Bourdieu, and I would posit, you know, Antonio Gramsci, right?
They're both connected.
People. Because there, you know, there is no division between culture and structure, right? And therefore that sort of, or history for that matter, right?
How is the culture trap constructed? How has, what role has the state and its actors played in its development and sustenance over time? And so, you know, the points you're lifting up, Elizabeth, makes me think about how in the 1960s, and this will be relevant for the contemporary moment, you know, following, you know, the passing of a whole slew of civil rights acts in, you know, the mid-1960s, you know, your conservative pundits drew on the case of Black Caribbeans to say, we didn't need affirmative action. Here was this other, this new cohort of Blacks, and look at them, like based on sort of economic output, home ownership, educational attainment. They were thriving. We don't need affirmative action, right? They were arguing because this group just had the right cultural stock, as it were, and, you know, to motivate them towards success.
Which is also an argument saying that the U.S. is really not racist, right?
Precisely, fundamentally, this is not about race. It's both about dismissing the sort of weighted category of race or anti-Blackness in particular, but just to say it comes down to a fundamental matter of one's sort of inner beliefs and drives, a drive, as it were, which just fundamentally limits history once again, and what shapes the presence and experiences of Black folks in the U.S. up until that point.
Right.
So, can I actually use that? This is sort of an ignorant question, because I'm just desperately trying to remember the way the rhetoric of the Moynihan Report, like in the original report, and then how it was taken. But could you just tell us more about that phrase culture of poverty? Because one of the things I really like about your work, Drawn, I think Elizabeth also likes it, like this notion that race, class, gender, and then the sort of the triad plus this possibility that culture exists as a kind of shadow category there. But the phrase culture of poverty, and you should correct me if I'm wrong, the way I remember it with the Moynihan Report, it's almost as if the word culture there has a bit of a shifter effect where it's attached to poverty, as if what's being perpetuated is like the endemic nature of being poor. Do you see what I mean? Rather than it being a separate category. Which is certainly a way of like deflating or deflecting Marxist class-based critiques, you know, because instead of seeing poverty as something that's an attribute of a class system, you see it as like inherent.
Right. If people just read to their kids more, then
precisely. Then which groups get represented as having that culture of poverty? I think that's the that's the part, right? It's on one hand, there's this loose you know, open-ended category that is the culture of poverty that can be attached to any group, you know, finding themselves steeped in poverty, right? But we know, owing to the structures of American society, disproportionately who those people are.
Yeah.
And more than that, we know the media's commitment to sort of the sort of repeated representation of those groups as being the ones in poverty.
Yeah.
Right.
right? Yeah. And so there's this sort of...
So does culture just become a cover? Oh, sorry. Go ahead. Sorry.
It's fundamentally racialized to your question.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? So we attach the culture of poverty, yes, though we know it's about, it's theorized as being relevant to a whole host of groups. It's seen as a representation of Black people in particular.
Right, right, exactly. Right. Right.
And that's so, fundamentally the problem, right? It's not, so on one hand, when you read the text, it's about, it's a, you know, and John, you may appreciate it, it's about interpretation on one hand,
yeah.
You know, but it's, you could also argue that in it's about its deliberate slyness, as it were, right? Its capacity to encode multiple meanings, right? That allows it to have sort of traction in the sort of public political discourse, but at the same time in sort of popular culture, media representation allows us to sort of reinforce dominant deficit perspectives of a particular, not simply a class group, but a racialized group.
So apropos of interpretation, this sort of comes to one of the things that I think is so interesting in your work and where you're crisscrossing this question of ethnic expectation and the culture trap in a couple of different ways. So that set of that sort of sleight of hand move you're describing there has to do with like a general public that is set up to receive something that is, you know, putatively race neutral, but actually racialized. Yeah. But you also have a set of arguments about the internalization of ethnic expectation. You know, that is the way in which these culture traps aren't just categories by which neutral data is interpreted for the benefit of policymakers. You're also talking about how this hits people's lives, right? I mean, school children especially. Can you say more about that? Is it, you know, like, is that where the rubber meets the road? That is when people come to get inculcated into the notion that they're culturally marked in one way or another?
Yeah, thanks so much for that question, John. I think it's at least one point where the rubber meets the road, and it feels significant. Because the in internalizing these logics at different junctures, for me, the rationalization about why that logic has traction is what I find most fascinating, right? So folks would genuinely say they work hard. Well, what allowed you? What might have allowed you to work hard, right? So again, this sort of quiet but significant weighty presentism that sort of shapes on our understanding of even Caribbean success here, right? Well, we know and I uncover this in the book, in the 1920s, immigration policy necessitated that only those proficient, highly proficient in English language were allowed migration from the Caribbean.
Mm.
That then becomes a code for recruiting the sort of middle classes and the elites to come to the United States. But rather than being represented as sort of a middle class Black Caribbean people, they're simply seen as it's Caribbean culture. Mm-hmm. That is what I refer to as a secret life of social class. Like, class is shaping the quality of representation we see of a particular group in a national context, right? People, when students, when teachers think that this is just a matter of culture, when social class is playing such a profound role and they're not able to see it in some cases, that's when it hits me the most. What I also found most moving in my... in the context of doing this ethnography, was just how much young people saw.
Mm.
I was floored, right? I spent a lot of time as a producer working with young people, but I walked away with a really clear sense that young people are savvy political actors, whether they have the vote or not. And they're able to recognize structural and cultural inequalities that were sedimented and regularized for teachers. And it, at least in the last chapter of the book, which I think is where a lot of things come to a head, the class clown becomes, you know, the teacher's chief critic, you know, challenging him on what he describes as, you're using our culture against us.
Those
were his words, right? The kid who opens up the book making fun, right? And having this interaction with his teacher. So for me, it's in, see, culture has its power, not simply, you know, in the sort of meaningful theorizations we may advance, right? In the sort of quality of works we may produce. It has profound implications in schools and society because it shapes teacher and student dispositions, who we are, what we believe about ourselves and what's possible. It therefore has implications for democracy. It therefore has implications for even social welfare and who we believe deserves or not, right? It's a case for a whole host of larger points about how society is structured and who's deserving and who's not.
Can you say more about that? I love that point about the awareness. It almost reminds me of like the Lukács argument about reification in the class consciousness of the proletariat, where he basically says that you need to be in the position of the proletariat in order to have the correct structural understanding. Because a lot of times I hear that argument run, like I think about, forgive me if I'm using this phrase wrong, but there's a category stereotype threat, you know, the notion that people are basically stigmatized and sort of set up for failure because they're imagining what the expectation is for them. And that, I think, understands, let's say, school children, let's imagine it for that case, as disabled by these cultural predispositions. But the thing you just said was like, you see the kids in that situation as actually having an angle on it. Like they have, they have some traction.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
They have some traction. And it isn't universal. They don't always have it. It is situational. It's contextual.
Right.
And often when they are most disadvantaged by the structures of power.
Right.
When you flip the case, right, these Black Caribbean students, when they're celebrated in New York and African Americans are being put down in schools, they don't see that.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That is not as concerning to them. But when their teacher starts to use their culture as what the sociologist Diane Ray regards as an ideological whip, as a way for getting them in line, they see that and want to resist it. More than that, as I bring up in the sort of gender chapter, and this was peculiar for me as well, in a cross-national study, you often expect to say things are different, things are different. But in that chapter on gender, I was like, wow, they're actually what the Black Caribbean boys are experiencing in both London and New York is the same. And what the Black Caribbean girls in London and New York are experiencing is the same. And the point I'm trying, and I can unpack this a little bit. I want to stay germane to the point you're making or the question you posed, John.
Yeah, but just say a little more about that because it was so interesting.
Yeah, so let me make the point first and I'll use examples. Okay. The boys did not recognize how the general concern about, you know, Black boys being a beleaguered party, this underachieving group needing all this help, how it afforded them levels of privilege in school. They didn't see it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
In fact, when you read the book closely, I was very forthright in sort of saying there were moments where I was in conversation with these girls and they're like, you don't see it? How could you not see it? And I was like, maybe you're just like, let's dig a little bit deeper. And, you know, I was greeted with eye rolls and neck rolls and, you know, really, why my own male privilege growing up in a Caribbean context meant that I too had benefited from this and I didn't see it despite my own political consciousness. I'm using it as an example to say, again, what are the moments when we see and we don't see structural and cultural inequalities, right? And that isn't peculiar to young people. It isn't peculiar to Black Caribbeans. I could talk about our own faculty.
I could
talk about the wider society and local community. I could talk about the sort of middle classes moving into working class neighborhoods and, you know, when it's okay, you know, Black middle class people moving into Black working class neighborhoods and when it's reclamation versus when it's gentrification. I mean, these are the sort of nuances I wanted to lift up in the book.
Yeah.
To the examples you were asking about before, Elizabeth, I found that, you know, in the latter part of the book, I focus on three cultural logics that Black Caribbean students use in pursuit of success: distinctiveness, deference, and defiance. And I can say more about each of those, but the one most relevant is deference. It's this ideological investment in good behavior and comportment as being relevant to one's success. And what I learned in the context of pursuing this work and write about in the book is that it was profoundly a gendered ideological frame, right?
Right.
And that the rewards were starkly different for boys than girls. So in a context in both London and New York City where Black boys were deemed to need sort of policy and social support to sort of aid in their achievement, those boys then were praised for, they experienced what I call complimentary deference or deference for the sake of receiving praise. They got praise for just showing up to class on time, raising their hands on occasion in class, right?
Yeah.
You know, in one case, just guessing an answer to a question, right? This kid was beating his chest because he was proud. The girls, the Black Caribbean girls on both sides of the Atlantic were not praised because of their behavior. They practice what I call compulsory deference, right? Yeah. And that's because they did not receive praise by virtue of behavior, because they're supposed to be deferential. They're girls, right? It's a compulsory formula. That's what girls do.
Right.
You fall in line. And so they could only receive praise through high academic achievement. And this was true in both national contexts, right? And so what we're seeing there is that in this attempt to sort of support boys, they're engendering this sort of low gendered expectations for Black Caribbean boys on both sides of the Atlantic, where they're easily praised. And the praise is supposed to be an attempt to sort of support their advancement.
Right.
But it actually helps to keep them back. The girls, on the other hand, who in their everyday social life wish to be praised for showing up on time or participation, get none of that. It's only through the pressure of high academic achievement that they're able to garner those rewards. And I wasn't even able to see that. It was completely revelatory for me, because I can now look back on even my own educational experience and see where I had benefited from the same thing relative to young women and girls who were far much smarter than I was.
Mm.
But I, you know, my good behavior was rewarded, right? And I was encouraged, right?
Well, as you're describing it, it's not exactly a benefit, right? Because if the effect of it is a kind of, it is a negative payoff, because
I would say, but it's both and, because it, at least in real time, the immediate reward is that the teacher is recognizing that student, that boy, in a way that she or he or they would not recognize a girl.
Right.
In real time, it, particularly in the context relationally among students, they can recognize that something is different there.
It's,
right? Even though over the long haul, it helps to sort of limit, it's putting a cap on sort of behavioral expectations for Black women boys. Because, you know, boys will be boys. They're going to be silly. They're going to run around. They're going to do, they're going to be unruly. And that's, again, that's not unique to just Black Caribbean boys. Or
no, I mean, it
I can name a whole host of boys.
It reminds me a lot of, you know, parenting expectations, for instance, of, you know, both my husband and I had full-time jobs when the kids were little, and, you know, we shared the caretaking, but every time, and he would say this himself, right? Every time he did anything, it was like, oh, it's so incredible. You know, that's such a great dad, right? Whereas, you know, I was always on the, you know, very much on the teetering margin of acceptability for, you know.
I have come to learn, this is a more on the personal side, but my partner and I, my wife and I, we joke about this, because she's very sort of very diplomatic and very incredibly thoughtful. But if you want to upset her very quickly, begin praising me for basic parenting. Oh my
God. I know, right?
She loses it. And she reminds me, this is her words, this is your reasonable service. You're not doing anything extra here. There's nothing that's worthy of praise. We are doing this together. But it's again another case, another example of how that very gendered logics, right, travel across time and space and across a whole host of ethnocultural groups. And these are some of the dynamics that could quickly get dismissed or relegated or simplified to merely being a matter of culture, that I want us to see how both race, gender, and social class shapes the representation of cultures across contexts and across time.
Right. That's fantastic. So maybe this is a great moment to shift to our recallable books section of the of the episode. And Duran, are you ready?
Do you have some for us? Yeah, there are a few pieces that come to my mind. Can I name at least three? Is that okay?
Yeah.
So one that's had a profound impact on me is Bernard Cord's How the West Indian Child is Made Educationally Subnormal. It is the text that then shaped Steve McQueen's, at least the fourth episode of Steve McQueen's Small Acts, focused on education. And interestingly, Bernard Cord is a Brandeis alum. He's also from the Caribbean, and he did his work in the very area I wrote this in.
That's amazing.
World aside, when we connected afterwards, I was like, this is uncanny. Felt like the very calling, because he was pushed to write that book based on community actors who were saying, if you're in these schools seeing what's happening with our kids, you need to write this. And that's precisely what happened to me when I described the differences across the two national contexts. Members of my community was like, well, if you can't find a book, you need to do it. You know, I need an answer. You should tell me.
So Duran, say the title again, just so we can hear it. Yeah.
Bernard Cord's How the West Indian Child is Made Educationally Subnormal, published in 1971.
It's such a striking title.
And it's striking because going back to arguments about the state, I use the U.S. example around affirmative action. Well, in the late 40s, 50s, 60s, into the 70s, the British government disproportionately labeled Black Caribbean students as, and I quote, educationally subnormal. That was the language of the state. That is how you reproduce the representation of a particular cultural group and sustain that over time. Right? Yep. This isn't just about what people are thinking or believing. The state plays a role in structuring these representations. Back to the to other books, I'm thinking too about Bernardine Evaristo's Girl, Woman, Other. A really just very provocative book that I think is so well done. I enjoy that. The other I just want to lift up, which falls slightly outside of that tradition. This is a book written by a scholar, a sociologist of Southern studies, I think you would say. He's a scholar called B. Brian Foster. He's at the University of Virginia. His book is called I Don't Like the Blues, Race, Place, and the Backbeat of Black Life. It is, for me, it is my favorite ethnography of 2021 by far. I just, there is a text where that is so steeped in Southern culture that both in the language and the attention to detail, the theorizations that are being advanced, the quantitative data brought to bear was just a level of sophistication I've so appreciated. I read parts of the book and there are moments where I would just throw the book on the floor. I was like, I can't believe you just said that. Right? The prose was so lush. It's poetry and it's sophisticated empirical analysis. I love it.
Oh, great.
And I got a chance to, you know, I don't know Brian personally, but we crisscrossed at ASA, at the American Sociological Association this summer, and I just had to find him and tell him, like, you know, this is what I think of your work and I've been telling other people, but I need to tell you to your face. Like, this is a really good book. So those are the three that come to my mind.
Wonderful.
That's great. And, that's fantastic.
And those will all be there on the website so that people can look them up. So I have a couple of things. One is, John might laugh because I, you know, this is my, it's either Anthony Trollope or Michelle Rolfe trio with me. It's like pretty much goes back and forth between the two. So in this case, an essay, a kind of a difficult essay, but brilliant by the, late anthropologist Michelle Rolfe trio, which is called Idea Culture, which is about the culture concept in the United States. And it traces its, you know, one thing that trio is really, really has a really light touch with is the life of concepts and the ways in which concepts change and how concepts and words are not the same thing, that you might have the same word, but the concept is changing and has different kinds of histories. And we really see that with culture. And, you know, he talks about the ways in which the concept of culture in a kind of Boasian tradition in anthropology was really developed, you know, not perfectly and certainly in, you know, ways that are of its time, but quite pointedly, to intervene in a conversation about race as an anti-racist project, and the ways in which that shifted to the kind of use of culture that you're documenting, where culture is actually a way of avoiding talking about race, and race comes in through the back door in a sense, right? So really fascinating essay. Not one of the ones that is normally read by a trio, so I think a really good one. And then the other thing I was going to suggest, and you really, if we had more time or maybe later over drinks or something, I want to ask you, because you were a little reticent maybe on this, how you felt about this, but The Wire, the TV show The Wire.
But it wasn't me, right? It was the participants in the study.
Sorry?
So you're saying I'm reticent. I wouldn't say it's necessarily me. It's the participants in the study, right? And what they were.
You said something about The Wire. You have it as a representative, if I understood you right, of a certain kind of representation of the ways in which the U.S. educational system treats Black students. And I'm just curious how you think about that.
Right.
For instance, you know, there are other. and now I'm going to forget the name. I think it's Stand and Deliver is the name of the movie, right? The other movie that you describe in that.
Lean on me.
Yeah. Right.
And I think what I'm trying to say is it's participants who are bringing these up. And I've, you know, trying to be a good interviewer saying, well,
okay,
don't you realize, or what do you think this actually represents? Do you think this is actually what's happening? Do you see what I mean?
Right. So that's
I didn't want to bring these up, but yeah, there's also another movie in the UK context with Sidney Poitier, where he is this Guyanese head teacher who gets recruited into Britain in the 1960s. Uh-huh. Right.
Yeah, Mr. Chips or something, is it?
Or To Sir With Love, there's that.
To Sir With Love. With Love.
Oh, that was with it. Love, right, yeah, love. Yeah.
Right, and so, furiously, no one was talking about the culture of poverty among the white working classes at the time, right, and how these students
were
poorly behaved and how they needed to recruit this teacher, but that's, as you say, Elizabeth, perhaps for another time and over drinks for us to
But you know, so to me, the difference between The Wire and a lot of those films is that it's has a much more kind of Bourdieuian sort of notion of how, I mean, it's certainly representing schools in certain ways. And I think that, you know, that would be a good conversation, but it doesn't have the kind of heroic narrative that you see in a lot of these things. It's much more, everybody's kind of playing the hands they're dealt. They're all quite complex actors. And that's what I love about it. So that it has this sort of, degree to which its notion of culture to me aligns a lot more with what I see in your analytic frame, not your description of how the concept of culture is working in your ethnography. So, I'm a fan. So that's my recallable. Yeah.
We should try to teach a class about The Wire, which I think colleagues have done at other universities, but I don't know if you've seen Top Boy, which has become...
I love Top Boy.
Yeah. Wait, so what is Top Boy? I don't know what Top Boy is.
Yeah, folks crudely regard to it as the UK's Wire.
Right, huh. Right.
Right. And so it's available.
Really, really good. I haven't seen the last season, but yeah, no, it's great.
I have. Yeah, I watched it a couple of weeks ago when it came. But yeah, John, you should watch it, and then we can have a quick conversation about it.
That sounds great. I'm excited.
I'd be remiss if I didn't mention at least one text by Stuart Hall, and I'll close this piece, The Fateful Triangle, by Stuart Hall, Race, Ethnicity, and Nation, based on lectures he gave at Harvard. I found to be really, it's among his lesser known works, but I think it's just so rich in its theorization of race, ethnicity, and the nation state for the reproduction of sort of structural and cultural inequalities. And so, you know, I don't think we've, at least in sociology, there's been this awakening over the past 8 or so years in sort of thinking through the relevance of Du Bois as a sociologist, as a number crunching sociologist. And as I say this, there are historians sitting down, shaking their heads, saying, we've known this the whole time.
Yeah, right.
Sociology has sort of finally come into this moment, or US sociology has finally come into this moment. And what I argue, what I strongly believe, is this, just as Du Bois has sort of been brought into the center of sort of US sociology, I think Stuart Hall deserves the same in British sociology, right? Mm-hmm. And that he too ought to be taught as part of the canon. Instead, he gets relegated to simply being a matter of cultural studies that isn't necessarily cultural sociology, right? And we know very disciplinary boundaries cultural studies mean to challenge in the first place, right? And to draw on the tools of literature and of art and a film that sociology in and of itself couldn't provide. And so for those reasons, I think this text is one I'd recommend to anyone interested in cultural studies broadly or to cultural sociology specifically.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. Okay, well, always good to end with Stuart Hall. So so I just want to thank you, Duran, so much for taking the time. And and thanks to John, and thanks to our listeners.
Thank you, Elizabeth and John. This is, I've enjoyed this. Thank you.
Wonderful.
Recall This Book is the creation of John Plotz and Elizabeth Ferry. Sound editing is by Kamaya Bagla, and music comes from a song by Eric Chaslow and Barbara Cassidy. We gratefully acknowledge support from Brandeis University and its Mandel Center for the Humanities. We always want to hear from you with your comments, criticisms, or suggestions for future episodes. Finally, if you enjoyed today's show, please forward it to 5 people or write a review and rate us wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.